This is Forum. I'm John Michaels, Public Affairs Radio Director, and with us today we have Sheriff Mike Milstead. But you've been sheriff for how long?
15 years.
You run for election how often?
Every 4 years.
And it's an elected position because people have seen you for so long, they begin to forget that it's elected in a sense. But Sheriff, how much more do you have on your term now?
Well, I have 2 years left, and you know, I love what I do. It's interesting. I spent over 24 years with the Sioux Falls Police Department, you know, and that's not an elected position. And I've been the elected sheriff now for 15 years. I love what I do. I loved my experience with Sioux Falls. And, you know, fortunately, Chief Barthel and I worked side by side on the police department together. So our agencies work in partnership on many fronts to try to keep our community safe. And I just feel really fortunate we've got such a great working relationship between the city and the county.
The city's changed quite a bit in 20 years, hasn't it?
In 20 years, absolutely, and in 40 even more.
Sioux Falls is now in Lincoln County, and you've been part of that kind of transition a little bit.
While Sioux Falls, Minnehaha County continues to grow by leaps and bounds, so does Lincoln County, and especially because it was a small rural county and is one of the fastest growing counties in America because of the growth of Sioux Falls and the metropolitan area.
We hear about federal cutbacks on March 1st. If the actual cutbacks go into effect, is that going to affect federal funding for law enforcement in our area?
You know, it could have some long-term impacts on some of the grants that we receive from the federal government. There's no immediate impact that we see if the sequestration happens, and you know, so we're going to operate normally. We don't have that much dependence on federal grants. And, you know, a lot of what you're seeing is not directly related to longer-term grants.
Well, a lot of people don't realize just how extensive the Minnehaha County Sheriff's Department is. How many miles of roads are we talking about?
Well, you know, we have 800 square miles in Minnehaha County, and a lot of township roads and rural areas. Our sheriff's office not only provides patrol services in those rural areas, but we also serve as a local police department in all of our rural communities with the exception of Brannan. So if you go to Del Rapids or Hartford or Humboldt, Colton, Crooks, Valley Springs, you know, Garrettson, we're their police department as well.
Do you have offices in those locations?
I do. The communities contract with us. They pay an hourly rate. They pay about 75% of the actual cost because it's a great advantage for the county to have that unified structure. And also, if I didn't have the contract in Del Rapids, for example, where we're there around the clock, I'd need to have a deputy up in that area anyway to respond to rural crime. And so having the deputies up there works very well, and working in partnership with all of the cities that we do just makes good fiscal sense.
And that works with the jail system also.
It works. Yeah, it does. We run a regional jail. Lincoln County doesn't have a jail. You know, Turner and McCook, and they rely on other jails, and we actually contract with about 14 counties who house their prisoners with us sometimes. And our jail's a big operation. You know, we have a 400-bed maximum security capability jail in a downtown location, and then we can house a little over 200 inmates out at the Work Release Center, which is the old Elks Club.
So you actually have a food budget that's pretty large.
Yeah, we do. I mean, with, you know, 600 inmates in custody, we're feeding about, you know, 1,500 to 1,800 meals a day.
Well, give us an idea of just how big the economic impact is on the city of Sioux Falls. First of all, how many jobs do you provide?
Well, the sheriff's office, between all of our operations, has about 250 full and part-time people. For the most of those are full-time. But, you know, if you look at all of our operations, we have our corrections division, which, you know, accounts for about 140 of the staff. But we also do the court security. We do, we're responsible for all the civil process in the community, and they serve about 18,000 civil process, whether that's protection orders or subpoenas and judgments and executions and all of the things that we do. We do the foreclosures. We have a warrants division and a fugitive task force. So those all take people. We contract services not only with the rural communities, but we also contract as the security at the South Dakota Air National Guard base in a partnership we have with our National Guard. We contract as the security at Southeast Tech and have a number of other obligations by statute that you know, we fulfill. So it takes quite a group of people, but I've got some really hard work and dedicated professional staff, and I'm honored that I have those kinds of people working for me.
Well, having to serve papers to somebody is not an easy job sometimes. Debt collection sometimes is what you do, and that's not easy either.
Right, it's not. And, you know, we're selling properties, foreclosed homes, you know, have to sell someone's business or property because of a judgment or execution. And so, you know, there's a lot of those things that we do in addition to, you know, seeing the deputy sheriff car going down the road, going to an accident or a family fight or a bar fight.
Now, are you going to have sheriff's auction coming up? When do they occur?
Well, we post those auctions regularly. Quite frankly, John, we have a lot of foreclosure auctions. It happens, you know, more than I'd like to admit that we have to go through foreclosures. Foreclosure sales are held on the courthouse steps. Now, in many instances, they get canceled right before the sale. And in other instances, the bank may buy the property back. If someone stops paying their payment today, it's about a year from now before the actual foreclosure sale would occur. And during that time, the banks try to work out some way to, you know, resolve the situation or to bring the buyer or the homeowner current on their payments to avoid foreclosure. And sometimes that's at the last minute.
Have you had to do another hard thing would be to evict people? Has that had to be done pretty often lately?
We frequently are involved in the process of eviction and serving notice of eviction and actually in some cases where they don't voluntarily leave, do what's called a lockout, which is an eviction, and it's you know, it's the armed deputies that go there. And we have a separate civil section that handles that process, and they're not real popular with some of the people that they have to deal with, but then again, they're carrying out orders of the court, they're carrying out due process, and that's the way we operate, and that's the expectation.
We're speaking with Sheriff Mike Milstead, Minnehaha County. A lot of legislation talking about carrying handguns, concealed permits, that is up quite a bit. What is your view on out here in the Wild West, you might say, in South Dakota, a lot of people would rather carry a gun, I guess.
It's interesting. There's a lot of legislation, not only in South Dakota, but across America and in Congress, looking at violence and tying guns to violence, obviously. The sheriffs in South Dakota have had lengthy conversations about this. We actually drafted and agreed upon a resolution that kind of outlines our belief, which is that a lot of the finger pointing at the particular guns, we don't see that as being effective. The reality of it is the violence that we're seeing in America is, I don't believe it's directly related to the kind of gun that it is or how many bullets it holds. And if somebody believes that, you know, saying you can only have 9 rounds in a gun instead of 15, that it's going to change the culture that we've seen and the violence that we've seen, I think they're sadly mistaken. I think that the crumbling moral values that we've seen, the family unit breakup that happens way too much. We've got some kids who are thrown away, not runaways. We've got violence on television and in movies, and you can go buy video games where, you know, you gain extra points by, you know, killing people, killing policemen, running over innocent bystanders. What's happening in America is certainly not something that I think needs to be blamed on the fact that a gun holds X number of rounds. Quite frankly, I don't think that the previous assault weapons ban reduced crime, and in fact, after it expired, crime has gone down. And so I'm concerned about maybe some moves in particular out in D.C. From some that would just assume people don't have any guns. And I'm really not in that group. I'm a strong believer in the Second Amendment. And quite frankly, even all of our sheriffs in South Dakota agreed that, I'll just read one little piece of that, and that's that we support the Second Amendment. We look to our lawmakers to provide legislation based on meaningful discourse that addresses the complexity of evil and mental health and public safety and the preservation of civil rights. And that we think that the gun violence must be addressed in many fronts, including mental health treatment, drugs, the breakdown of the family, the strengthening of laws that prevent or reduce access of legally prohibited persons to firearms, and vigorous enforcement of existing laws. We have plenty of laws on the books, and I think one thing we do have to recognize, though, is ultimately when there's a challenge of the constitutionality of these laws, the Constitution itself says that the way the person or the group that decides constitutionality of the law is the Supreme Court. And so one of the pieces of legislation going around in Peer right now that I'm supportive of and have had discussions with our Attorney General, Marty Jackley, and a bill that he supports, Senate Bill 207, might be worth watching. I think this week it'll be coming up again. Mm-hmm. And Senate Bill 207, one of the things that it does is it says, and I'm just going to read the very last part of the bill. It just says, "We hereby direct the Office of Attorney General to be vigilant and proactive in protecting, by litigation if necessary, the rights of South Dakota and its citizens against all dilution and diminution of the Second Amendment rights from whatever source and whatever means." And so the instruction is that this bill is saying if the federal government passes laws that restrict South Dakotans' right to own firearms or what kind of firearm they can have, that they're tasking the Attorney General to make sure that anything they pass is constitutional and does not infringe on our citizens' rights.
I find it kind of interesting if you look back at the old Wild West. Wyatt Earp always said you can come into town, but you got to check your guns at the sheriff's office. And even Marshall Dillon said you can go into the bar, but you got to check your guns first. There was kind of everybody had guns, but there was somewhat of a control back then even.
There was, and today if you walk into a bar, there's a sign that says, don't bring your gun into our bar. And so South Dakota has been pretty good about passing laws to say, yeah, there's a Second Amendment, but there are some restrictions. And I think South Dakota has been really good at making sure that people who want to carry a gun for their personal safety and their own personal defense or to hunt, that they're able to do that. And I believe that that's the way it should be. There's a little bit of confusion sometimes when you get out in the Washington, D.C. area that they think that the Second Amendment had something to do with being able to go pheasant hunting, and it didn't.
Well, now you have a video, I think after the tragedy at Sandy Hook, you put a video on your website that kind of helps people, I guess, if they run into a situation like that. First of all, where's your website?
Well, if you go to our website at minnehahacounty.org, and go to the sheriff's office, there will be a link in the sheriff's office to two resources. One of them it's a video called Run, Hide, and Fight. And at shortly after Sandy Hook, I had people calling asking, Sheriff, what are there any recommendations out there or ideas that people in the workplace could have, or citizens in general, to know what to do if there was ever the unthinkable, an active shooter somewhere at the workplace or where they're at. And so I researched that. Our Office of Emergency Management, the County Office of Emergency Management, researched it. We located a video that was done by Department of Homeland Security and the Houston Mayor's Office, actually, in Texas. And it was very well done, well thought out. I called the mayor's office, talked with them, and they were supportive of us, expanding the viewing of that, and so we put that on. It's a short video, just a few minutes, but it really gives some pretty good common sense instructions if someone is ever faced with that, and in particular good for training staff, just for employees to view. And then there was one other resource, and that's that FEMA had a self-study course. It takes about an hour, kind of a similar, but a little more in detail. And I just think those are good things to have out there available for those who would like to do them.
Now, if schools in Minnehaha County have any of the rural schools, I mean, there's more than just Sioux Falls, have they talked to you about having maybe protection?
Well, we've had conversations with all of our school superintendents in Minnehaha County. In fact, it was shortly after. We do regularly, but it was shortly after Sandy Hook. And we haven't had any of them come to us and say, please, you know, send deputies and post them at our doors and arm our schools. And, you know, I think they recognize that there needs to be a reasonable response to this. You know, we need to work on enhancing security. We have school resource officers in our rural schools. However, they're not always there all the time. Quite frankly, we've seen some proposals coming from all different places that say maybe we should just put, you know, arm the janitor or put armed guards at the front door of every school in America. And I think that just a basic budget calculation is that's about an $8 to $9 billion a taxpayer expense if you were to do that. And I don't know that one armed officer at the front door of a school is going to do anything to make that school 100% safe.
Well, most schools are within a pretty good response time of a phone call.
And they are. Now, I also look at, you know, the legislature's looking at some of those bills, the school sentinel bill, ideas for what about those rural schools where if they call 911, it could be 20, 30 minutes. And so they're, you know, I certainly don't fault them for trying to think through this. And I think that that's what it takes. It takes local control, I think, is critical. I think working through the issues and dealing with it and trying to work with your law enforcement to see if you can enhance security. But America can't afford to put, you know, 2-3 officers at every school, because in reality, take a grade school, for example. If you posted a full-time policeman at a grade school, what happens when the recess bell goes off? Where does that officer go? To go out the playground? Well, then who's at the front door? Well, what about the school buses? There's more people on a school bus than there is in a classroom. Are you going to have a policeman on every school bus? So, I mean, you can make America as safe as you can afford, but the reality is some of the solutions being tossed around are extremely expensive and may not be effective.
Well, if we look at where we're at, we're in the crosshairs of two major interstates, the northwest or north and south corridor of 29 and east-west. You can go on I-90 in Buffalo, New York, you know. Drugs, are we seeing more of it?
You know what? We're seeing an increase in the number of methamphetamine labs. I mean, just the other day, we had the methamphetamine lab that was dumped out at Family Park. And, you know, my concerns about that, we know we have some of those lab dumps, but those are extremely toxic. Fortunately, it didn't get dumped into the water because the water's really hard this time of year. But the reality of it is these toxic chemicals, they get dumped into our lakes and streams. They contaminate houses. We're seeing an increase in it. We're seeing an increase in what's called the one pot method, which is a little easier for people to make. You go, they're going to the internet and they're learning how to do it. And it's extremely dangerous. A lot of people are in burn hospitals today because they were doing a one pot method. Very explosive, very dangerous, very toxic chemicals. The other thing that we're seeing in South Dakota is an increase in the use of opiates, and in particular legally prescribed opiates. And an example would be hydrocodone and OxyContin. Now those, if you ask a physician, they'll tell you that they're very important pain medications, very effective and very necessary for the treatment of pain, and I agree. But what's happened in South Dakota is just like across the nation, people are recognizing the ability to abuse those drugs. And an 80 milligram tablet of hydrocodone or OxyContin carries a street value of about $80. And so if you've got a health plan or something that allows them to get, you know, 30 pills a month supply for $15, they've got about a $2,400, you know, supply for them and their friends. And what they'll do is they'll grind it up and they'll snort it, or they'll put it in some water and they'll directly inject it. And to just give you an idea of the sheer volume of hydrocodone being prescribed in the state of South Dakota, 2012, there were 16,675,000 hydrocodone pills and 6 million oxycodone pills prescribed in the state of South Dakota, a state of 780,000 people. So there's a lot of that stuff out there.
A lot of chance for abuse. One thing that's going to surpass drugs as a crime is human trafficking. Are we starting to see more of that, or starting to find more of that?
Well, we are seeing more human trafficking, or like you say, maybe we're identifying more of it. More people are coming forward. It's somewhat like as we improved our ability to recognize and arrest people on domestic abuse, because people were more willing to come forward and report that. I think we're seeing that with human trafficking. I'll say that our U.S. Attorney Brennan Johnson has been on the front of the charge to hold people accountable of the Sioux Falls Police with their operation on their street crimes task force that had been working aggressively on the prostitution market in our community. I had a detective that worked a 1-year case with federal partners that resulted in a life sentence, which is almost unheard of in that type of a case. But that shows, that there is not only a market for 12, 13, 14-year-old kids out there, but we're only catching a few of them with what we're doing. There are these kids are leaving home and becoming victims. They're being drawn away, and it's important in our community to be aggressive on that.
I've heard talk about gangs coming in through the Indian reservations, Pine Ridge, up through Nebraska and that, because they're vulnerable, they're susceptible. We're talking about dangerous gangs that do drugs and human trafficking. That's getting pretty close to Sioux Falls, isn't it?
It's really close. We have 9 reservations, in the area, and the gangs, they look for the easiest target or where they may be less likely to be reported. There's a great distrust for law enforcement in certain areas and on some of the reservations in particular. And if the neighbors aren't willing to call and say, hey, I suspect activity, you're less likely to be able to intervene with that. Gangs can hold a stronghold. Sometimes that distrust is deserved. There have been significant issues sometimes in different communities, and we have to be able to recognize that they can reach out. And the trouble is that the gangs are not looking for support. They're looking for victims. They're looking for people to use what they deal in.
Well, we've got just a few minutes left, Sheriff Mike Milstead. In the legislature, anything that people need to be looking at?
Senate Bill 207, that's the one with the Attorney General and the gun rights. I think that's a good one to keep an eye on. I'm pleased that Senate Bill 70 passed. Senate Bill 70 was the governor's total transformation of part of our criminal justice system, which I think is going to help reduce recidivism. I think it's going to impact and reduce the rising number of prison beds and still hold criminals accountable. I think the governor really did this the right way. He reached out to chiefs and sheriffs and judges and prosecuting attorneys a year ago and started this process. And it was well thought out, and I think that I'm optimistic that it's going to have an impact. It's going to impact me. It's going to have an impact on our jail, because we're going to probably see more people short term in county jails as opposed to in prison. But that may not be a bad thing.
Are we going to see more in ankle bracelets?
Right, absolutely. Looking at, community supervision and electronic monitoring.
What's new on the horizon? Anything?
Oh, technology. As fast as the criminals recognize technology can get them things. Cyber attacks. I know that like most Americans that. There are state-sponsored cyber attacks on American citizens all the time. There's rooms full of people who do nothing in other countries than try to attack and get into your bank account, into critical personal identifiable information on our citizens, that type of stuff. So you're going to see increased security there. There's technology improvements in law enforcement, and as they come down the line, we have to make sure that before we utilize that technology, we recognize what the implication is on our citizens that we serve, so that the balance is correct. I think of the drone idea, and I'm not in a race to get a drone. Quite frankly, I think if I want to use a helicopter to peek into your backyard, I'm going to want to have a substantial court backing before I'm going to do that. So I'm not racing out and shopping in the drone magazine.
I wish we had more time. There's so much to talk about. Sheriff Mike Milstead of Minnehaha County, thank you for being with us on Forum.
Well, thank you and good morning.
Next, we're talking with Judy Howard, Director of Bethany Christian Services. What is Bethany Christian Services?
We're a child and family services agency. We're most probably known for doing adoptions, domestic and international adoptions. We're a global agency in 21 countries and do adoptions in about 15 or 16 of those.
We hear a lot about Russian adoptions. Are you getting a lot of people asking you about that?
Not right now. It has closed. We do get occasional inquiries about it, but right now we're going to have to wait and see what happens.
Well, tell us about how do you adopt a child here in Sioux Falls, South Dakota?
Well, it always requires that scary thing called a home study. But a home study really is just helping a family get ready and know what type of child that would be appropriate for them, the age of the child, what types of issues that a child might come for them. So their first step is just to attend an introduction meeting or an information meeting at an agency and see what fits them the best.
How long does it take?
Oh my goodness, that's a $64 million question. Average domestic adoptions, I think, take 1.5 to 2 years. And it just really depends on a lot of different things. International adoption varies anywhere from probably 1.5, 2 years from a completed paperwork to bringing a child home, and sometimes longer.
I had some friends, former neighbors, that adopted a young child from China. It took a while, but it's been well worth it.
Oh, yes. Definitely always worth it. The families have a lot of ups and downs to go through, but all of them will tell you it was worth it.
But we have many children here locally that are looking for someone to adopt.
As far as you're talking about out of the foster system, Definitely that's people we need people to do. We don't personally work with the foster care system, but do advocate for those children.
Well, tell us, Judy, you've got an event coming up here. When is that going to be and what is it?
We have a pastor and church leaders breakfast. Actually, anyone is welcome who is involved in orphan care and interested in that. We have Johnny Carr, who is a nationally known speaker and adoption advocate, especially for orphans. He is an adoptive father himself, and he has a book being released on March 1st called Orphan Justice. And it's a call to the churches or to the church on how they can care for orphans beyond just adoption. Not everybody can do adoption, but everybody can do something.
Well, how do you define an orphan?
Oh, it depends. It depends on where you're at, what the definition is. Orphan can mean that you just don't have parents to care for you.
What is the age of a child that can be in foster care? I guess up to 18 or 21?
You know, we don't do foster care, so I'm not entirely sure of that.
But as an orphan, how long can they, before they become independent, I guess?
Sure. And I think that depends on the country. We do mostly international adoptions where we do our older child adoption. And a child can come to the United States until they're age 16 or through age 16.
What countries do you deal with the most in?
Probably our most popular right now are still China, mostly special needs adoptions, though. And then African countries, Ethiopia, Ghana, Uganda, South Africa.
Do they actually go and visit the child in his home country?
Yes, they do. That's something that's a little bit scary to families, especially a lot of South Dakota families haven't traveled a lot. But it's an experience that really draws them closer and able to help their child in that assimilation when they come back to the United States.
Well, tell us about your event again. The date is
March 5th, and it's a breakfast, complimentary breakfast from 8 a.m. to 9:30. And Johnny Carr will be speaking. Roger Fredrickson will be opening up with devotions and prayer for us.
Roger Fredrickson, remember him from First Baptist Church?
Yep, the same one.
Now, how many churches are involved in this year?
That's to be determined.
Okay.
So it's whoever wants to come.
Well, Bethany Christian Services, where are you located?
We are at 400 South Sycamore Avenue in the old Osteds building, if you're old enough to remember that, right by 10th and Sycamore.
Again, is there any cost to go to this?
No cost at all.
Do they have to RSVP?
Please RSVP. That would be nice to have a count. We're asking people to RSVP by March 1st. You can RSVP as late as March 3rd on Monday. The number to call is 336-6999.
336-6999. That's an easy one to remember.
I hope so.
Do you have a website?
We do, bethany.org.
Bethany.org. Can people volunteer or help in some way?
Oh, definitely. We have lots of opportunities for that.
Well, it's all about the kids, isn't it?
It is, definitely. We want to find families for these kids that need a family.
Judy Howard, Director of Bethany Christian Services. Again, March 5th. What time?
8 a.m. to 9:30.
It's going to be everything you need to know about adoption from an expert.
Orphan care, beyond adoption. So, yeah,
okay.
From an expert.
There's quite a few that really need a home, isn't there?
There are millions of kids that need a family.
There's couples out there that I think would be great for that, and they can find out more information. Again, Judy Howard, Director of Bethany Christian Services, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, John.